That Lindsey Buckingham song, Go Your Own Way, was the first hit single off of an album that made history. The album was called Rumors, came out in 1977, and that was one of four top ten singles that came from that album, made by Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks and John and Christine McVie and Mick Fleetwood, plus the guys on the other side of the glass who produced and engineered that album, one of whom was my next guest, Ken Calais, who had worked with Billy Idol and Frank Sinatra and Pat Benatar and the Beach Boys and Herbie Hancock and Alice Cooper, and in January of 1976 went into a tiny little studio in Sausalito, California with the members of Fleetwood Mac, and when they were done, they had produced an album that not only would have four top 10 singles, but would top the Billboard 200 for 31 weeks, would become the fifth best-selling album of all time, some 40 million copies to date, would be named one of the top 25 greatest albums of all time by Rolling Stone, and would win the Grammy for the Album of the Year. Ken now has written a book looking back on that experience. It's called Making Rumors, the Inside Story of the Classic Fleetwood Mac Album, and he joins me now here on the Big 550. Hi, Ken. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing just great. Do you have the Grammy?
I certainly do.
So it goes to the producer for Album of the Year.
The producers. We all got one.
All of you were listed as producers on the album, including the members of the band. And when I think about this album, I was working in rock radio at the time, particularly top 40 radio. And I can remember 1975, the radio was taken over by Rhiannon and the other songs from the album just called Fleetwood Mac. And then this was the follow-up to that. And I had always heard that there was a lot of stuff going on in the studio while you were making that album, which became omnipresent on my radio shows in 1977 and ever since then. Tell me a little bit about how much the interpersonal relationships between the members of this band affected what ended up on what was then the vinyl of the album.
Well, it was about 100% interpersonal. It's funny that as I was going along, I used to ask continually to hear the lyrics and the melody so I could hear what's going on with the tracks. So normally we record a song track first with instrumentation first. So I would say, can I just hear the lyrics, naively enough? And I didn't realize that each of the lyrics was about, because all three of the couples in the band were breaking up.
Yep.
So I didn't realize it was all negative, and every time they'd sing the lyrics, somebody would walk out of the room and slam the door. Me being a little slow, it's like, what did I do? Was that me? But anyway, the songs were all written about each other, and because they were all going through a severe breakup with each other, but they realized, their management told them that the previous album was really soaring up the charts, and if they played their cards right, and they could just stay on course, and do a great job, do the same job they did on the previous record, they could be superstars. So they looked at each other and said, you know what? We're just going to put all this personal crap aside. We're going to make a record.
The couples that Ken is talking about here, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks, who had been a couple before even coming to Fleetwood Mac to replace Bob Welch in 1975, John and Christine McVie, who were divorcing at the time of Rumors, and Mick Fleetwood, who was being divorced by his wife, who was going off with another guy. So all of this was going on in the studio, and it seemed like it came through not just lyrically, but in the intensity of their performances. So how was it that when somebody would be singing a song about how much they didn't like another person in the room, you could still get them to... Did you have to play almost marriage counselor or psychotherapist in that room, Ken?
Well, No, not really. I just felt like I was the kind of guy that had to keep the ball rolling. So, okay, whatever your guys are fighting about, we got to get on. We're on schedule here. We're off schedule. We got to get back. So... But I mean, the funny thing about it was how it started. I came in innocently as a young engineer who hadn't done much before, never worked with been very close with a large rock band. And I get hired to do the job, and I'm sitting there in the studio, and I hear this little argument going on behind me. I turn around, and Christine McVie is just throwing a glass of champagne in John's face. And I went, well, you don't see this every day. But and then a few days later, Stevie and Lindsay were singing background parts to You Make Love and Fun. And as we stopped the tape to take a break, they turned to each other on microphone and just started screaming at each other and calling each other's names. And I couldn't get the tape started fast enough. And so that was the first two incidents that I found that where there was trouble in paradise.
Do you mean that somewhere you have tapes of these people screaming at each other?
No. No, those tapes were recorded over, but I wish I hadn't thought about it, keeping them.
So that's Christine McVie singing the lead there, and that's Stevie and Lindsay in the back doing the harmonies?
That's correct. That was also Lindsay Buckingham playing the tom fill in that chorus, which I think is very interesting because that was traditionally Mick's job, but Lindsay wanted a very aggressive, non-traditional tom fill, and Mick didn't feel he could do it. And when Lindsay started really starting out to take over and wanting to have things his way. And so he played the part himself, and it's kind of awkward when he told Mick that he did. But anyway, those are the tom fills in the chorus, not played by Mick Fleetwood.
When Lindsay and Stevie were arguing during the recording of that song, were they arguing about the recording of the song? In other words,
No. It was like, you're cheating on me. I'm sick of you. And I don't care, you go your own way or something like that. But it was about their relationship. There was just this buildup of animosity between the two of them. And I didn't know it.
But when it came to actually doing the work, were they critical of each other?
Well, they were very professional. This is the thing that I think was so amazing, that 90% of the time I didn't see anything. They would sing, they would collaborate on parts, they would do everything, but then there was a time when that was all they would do, and then they would go their own way. They'd walk in the other room and, well, I don't want to be with you now, but it was just, it was an amazing experience, and I guess I'm lucky to be there.
Talking with Ken Calais about his new book, Making Rumors, the inside story of the classic Fleetwood Mac album, here on the Big 550 KTRS with Paul Harris. You talked about Lindsay playing the toms on Go Your Own Way. You also write in the book about, at one point, he plays a chair.
Right.
Share that story with my audience.
Well, it's funny. He calls it Found Sounds, and it's interesting. We were recording the album, we typically, most people just go ahead and record the album, do the parts, but we were building a mansion, and we wanted the foundation to be strong. And so we kept taking the parts of the foundation apart and looking for ways to improve them. So we started talking about, there was kind of a feel missing from the song, kind of a lower end pulse. And we started discussing what could be a pulse. And I started going around the room thinking, well, what could we play? Didn't want to do a guitar. It was too typical. So we found a Naugahyde chair. He said, hey, how about this? Play the drumsticks on a Naugahyde chair. And that was it. Lindsay played it. And so that went on the record. So there's a Naugahyde chair going bup, 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 just underneath the sound level of that song.
Of which song?
Oh, Secondhand News.
Ken, is that the part where we're hearing Lindsey playing Naugahyde?
Yep, that was right there. Bop, 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 bop.
Yep.
And interestingly enough, that was Lindsey playing toms again on that fill.
What other non-musical instruments did you have to add to the mix here at various points? Or did the guys or men and women in the band say, hey, let's try this?
We were constantly saying, try this. We had a, well, they're all the rest of things were musical instruments, but we had a electric harpsichord. We did a tack piano that was got added on. We did a clavinet with through a wah-wah pedal where the clavinet had a nice, a clavinet's kind of a Stevie Wonder sound, a bum, 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 keyboard, and but we wanted it to be more wowy, so we ran it through this thing called a wah-wah pedal, and so the wah-wah pedal would sweep through the frequencies and wah, 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 wah. But Christine couldn't play the clavinet, the clav, and play the wah-wah pedal, so Mick, being the percussionist, got on his hands and knees next to Christine with the clavinet, and played the wah-wah pedal with his hands, not his feet. So we also found a jet phaser that we attached. This jet phaser just swishes, and that was a part of Goldust Woman, and we played that in the Goldust Woman. Mick actually wanted to play this electric harpsichord, so we had to mark off the keys that he could play, so he would play them in time, and he would just go boom, and then bop, a bop. And it was funny, the whole piano had black tape all over it. Looked like a homeless man.
How much of what you were doing in terms of innovation in the studio had been influenced by the innovations of Brian Wilson with the Beach Boys and George Martin with the Beatles some 8 or 9 years beforehand?
Well, I think it all was. We called it layering. We called it sound layering, and we wanted to fill the space between the speakers with a rainbow of colors that complemented each other and that helped build the song. And of course the song starts at the beginning and ends at the end naturally. And, it's always important for us to add a little bit more in the second verse than the first verse and so on. So the song keeps growing and crescendoing towards the end. So listening for these sounds were important. And a lot of times they were just guitar parts and background vocals, I think are one of the big pluses of what Fleetwood Mac does. They started learning that along the way, instead of just doing the typical background harmony that happens during the chorus as the song fades out, which is typically what would happen, they started turning it around, like You Make Love and Fun, and suddenly they would say, instead of the chorus of You Make Love and Fun, Lindsey White, throw in You Make Love and Fun. And so suddenly the whole rhythm section of the end vocals changed. It became a chant and became something that was a new hook to the song. And this is really something that most bands don't do. And Fleetwood Mac really developed it. I don't think they get enough credit for that.
And, of course, the hit Don't Stop from the 1977 Rumors album by Fleetwood Mac. My guest is Ken Calais, the man who produced that album with Richard Deshut and the members of Fleetwood Mac. Interestingly, that lyric, Yesterday's Gone, was supposed to be the original title of the album, wasn't it?
That's right.
Why'd they change it to Rumors?
You know, after being with a bunch of songs, 12 songs for 12 months, it's really, John McVie said, you know, this album is just a collection of rumors, is what he said. And somebody said, hey, that's a good idea. Why don't we, instead of calling it Yesterday's Gone, why don't we call it something more interesting? So that's Rumors stuck. And then John said, well, okay, let's spell it the English way, not the normal way.
Mm-hmm.
So just another creative addition by the band. You know, it's nothing set in stone. in Fleetwood Mac's music.
That song, Don't Stop, was co-opted by the Bill Clinton campaign and turned into his theme song in 1992. Were the members of the band on board with that?
Bill doing it?
Yeah.
I think everybody but Lindsey. Lindsey always felt that he didn't want to be thought of as a sellout. So I believe I wasn't really working with him very much, but I believe what I heard was that he wasn't that excited about doing it, but he reluctantly did.
What's interesting to me about that is I was thinking during the commercial break about the history of Fleetwood Mac, which people may not know before, you know, the Rhiannon Rumors era of the mid-70s, when they suddenly became a pop act when Lindsey and Stevie came on board. Before that, John McVie and Mick Fleetwood essentially had a blues rock band here. And then Lindsey comes in and leans them towards kind of this pop direction. Did that lead to any problems in the studio?
No, I don't. I think just the opposite. Up until then, they had been a blues band with Christine being a member and also John's wife. And so that was a beautiful thing for them. And then as soon as Bob Wells left the band, they needed a guitar player, and they found a duet in Stevie and Lindsey. And that fresh California sound, as it's, I read about it, is called, was just the thing that that put the band on the map, and it just changed everything for them, you know. And I really think if it wasn't for Stevie and Lindsey, Fleetwood Mac wouldn't be known today.
I actually asked Mick Fleetwood that same question about 15 years ago when I interviewed him. I asked him if he minded the change in direction. He said, "I minded right up until the checks cleared."
Exactly. I think I read that he thinks that he feels that Rumors was the most important album they ever did, and I believe it's the most important album they ever did also.
When we talk about your role as a producer and an engineer, along with Richard Deshut, the two of you had to literally go in and set up the microphones and figure out the acoustics of this tiny little studio in Sausalito and make everything sound the way it was supposed to. Were you also around when it was decided what the order of songs would be on the album? Because that was a much more important decision back in 1976 and 1977 than it is now, when people can just go to iTunes and download the songs and listen to them on shuffle in any order that they want on their iPhones or iPods. Were you involved in the ordering of the songs?
Absolutely, yeah. We call it the running order, and to this day, I still think it's one of the most important things, and it's back then, it was really an art to decide whether you should just put the songs in alphabetical order. Should you go from fast to slow? Should you go make it be a little roller coaster ride? Of course, then you had the added complexity of vinyl being a two-sided disc, so you had part one and part two. So, and when we were trying to decide what would be a running order, all of us were so intimately close to the record, I think it made it more difficult. Band's receptionist, Judy Wong, who had lived with Christine and the band in England for a number of years before they came to the United States, came into the studio, and she's a little Oriental woman. She's just cutest thing. She said, "Kenneth, I think you should let me have a shot at doing the running order." And I looked at her and I said, "Okay, Judy, you really don't really know the songs very well. I think I can do it." So she sits down, like 5-10 minutes later, she comes back, gives us a list. Stevie, Christine looked at it, and we all looked at it and went, "Holy mackerel, this is great." It started with a fast song, went to a slow song, then another fast song, then kind of up and down, ending with a slow song, and it was brilliant. So I think we had, in my book, I actually put all the songs that I offer people to, of course, there was timing considerations. You had to have the side one of the vinyl be the same side or close to it as side two. Otherwise, you've got a lot of real estate wasted. So in my book, I said, "Why don't you try to come up with a different running order?" Because it's not that easy, you know, working with the numbers and the musical feel. But anyway, it was Judy Wong, to make a long story short.
A song that didn't get on the original album was released as a B-side, a song called Silver Spring. Why was that left off?
That was a very painful decision. It was just too long. We had too many songs on the record. We had too many Stevie songs, and it was another slow song. And again, I explained that in my book. You almost have to look at it on paper. But the song was 4 minutes and 30 seconds. I think it used to be 7 or 8 minutes, and we edited it down to 4:30. But we couldn't find any place to fit it that didn't extend the side too long, and to make the rest of the songs on the side feel slower than we wanted to have we wanted people to walk away thinking, oh, that felt pretty good. That was like a positive. Yeah, that was felt good side. And we just couldn't get it to work. So it's I think my favorite song on Rumors. It's one of the best recorded songs. It's brilliantly orchestrated with all the layering, and it really broke our hearts to not put it on. It ended up being on the B-side of the first single, Go Your Own Way.
And it was included on later remasters and reissues with outtakes and demos, but it was not there. So instead, the album ended with another Stevie Nicks song called Gold Dust Woman. I'm going to stop it just for a second there, because you're the person I can ask this question I've wondered about ever since I played that song for the first time on the radio. What is going on with Stevie's voice there? There's a unique quality to it that doesn't show up on any other Stevie Nicks song I've ever heard. What is that?
Yeah, I think it's called attitude. You know, she really got behind this song, and she really kind of thought it had something to do. She wanted it to be witch-like, and the night we actually recorded her, the tag vocals, and she almost went into a trance. She sat in a dark room with candles, and she had a couple shots of Cavassier and whatever else she wanted to get in the mood. And she went out there, and with a little shawl over her head, she started howling on the microphone, like a banshee, which you'll hear at the latter end of the song. But I it was almost like my girlfriend, who was there at the time, said, "Wow, she's really a witch." And I had to ask her to say that again, make sure I knew what she said. But
if you'd asked Lindsay, he would have pronounced it differently.
Exactly.
Well, it really comes through in the song. Well, did she make you cry? It's really a beautiful lyric and a terrific piece of music, and it came to the end of the album there. But that was not the end of your collaboration with Fleetwood Mac. You went on and did other albums with them, including the Mirage album and their live album. And you also worked on the follow-up to this, an album called Tusk. And I know your book is only about Rumors, but may I ask you about recording the USC marching band for the title track of Tusk, and how difficult that was from an engineering standpoint?
Well, that was it was a challenge. I wouldn't say it was difficult. It was just a typical orchestra. You had to set it up, but we were in the middle of Dodger Stadium, so the company I used to work for, Wally Heider Recording, which is no longer in existence, had mobile trucks, and they brought the mobile truck out to Dodger Stadium, and we mic'd all of the marching band. The problem we realized soon is that we didn't have enough headphones or enough cabling to run headphones out to each of the musicians in the USC marching band, so they could hear the track and play to it in sync without getting out of sync. So we decided to give the conductor spare headphones, and so he listened to the track, and he kept the tempo for the orchestra with his baton. And so that didn't always work, because the track kind of went up and down a little bit. So we later had, once we recorded the song, we actually had to very, very, very speed the orchestra so it fits. And you can actually hear in the middle of the song, the orchestra kind of, we have to speed up the track, and you hear the orchestra kind of go, bop, 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 bop. And we caught it. But everybody thought it was a cool effect, so they patted me on the back like I did it on purpose. And
sometimes mistakes make magic.
Yep.
Well, you have certainly contributed to some musical magic through the years, Ken, and I'm always a fan of people who can tell me the process behind what they've done, and you've done a little bit of that here today, and a lot of it in this book, which is called Making Rumors, the Inside Story of the Classic Fleetwood Mac Album. I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Paul. You were great.
Grammy Award-winning producer Ken Calais here with Paul Harris.